Contemporary Art and the Plight of Its Public, 1962, by Leo Steinberg. A few words in defense of my topic, because some of my friends have doubted that it was worth talking about. One well-known abstract painter said to me, "Oh, the public, we're always worrying about the public." Another asked, "What is this plight they're supposed to be in? After all, art doesn't have to be for everybody. Either people get it and then they enjoy it, or else they don't get it and then they don't need it. So what's the predicament?" Well, I shall try to explain what I think it is, and before that, whose I think it is. In other words, I shall try to explain what I mean by the public. In 1906, Matisse exhibited a picture which he called The Joy of Life, now in the Barnes Foundation in Marion, Pennsylvania. It was, as we now know, one of the great breakthrough paintings of this century. The subject was an old-fashioned bacchanal, nude figures outdoors, stretched on the grass, dancing, making music or love, picking flowers, and so on. It was his most ambitious undertaking, the largest painting he had yet produced, and it made people very angry. Angriest of all was Paul Signac, a leading modern painter who was the vice president of the Salon des Indépendants. He would have kept the picture out, and it was hung only because that year Matisse happened to be on the hanging committee, so that his painting did not have to pass a jury. But Signac wrote to a friend, "Matisse seems to have gone to the dogs. Upon a canvas of 2.5 meters, he has surrounded some strange characters with a line as thick as your thumb. Then he has covered the whole thing with a flat, well-defined tint, which, however pure, seems disgusting. It evokes the multicolored shop fronts of the merchants of paint, varnishes, and household goods." I cite this affair merely to suggest that Signac, a respected modern who had been in the avant-garde for years, was at that moment a member of Matisse's public, acting typically like a member of his public. 1 year later, Matisse went to Picasso's studio to look at Picasso's latest painting, The Demoiselles d'Avignon, now in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. This, we now know, was another breakthrough for contemporary art, and this time it was Matisse who got angry. The picture, he said, was an outrage, an attempt to ridicule the whole modern movement. He swore that he would sink Picasso and make him regret his hoax. It seemed to me that Matisse, at that moment, was acting typically like a member of Picasso's public. Such incidents were not exceptional. They illustrate a general rule that whenever there appears an art that is truly new and original, the men who denounce it first and loudest are artists. Obviously because they are the most engaged. No critic, no outraged bourgeois can match an artist's passion and repudiation. The men who kept Courbet and Manet and the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists out of the salons were all painters. They were mostly academic painters, but it is not necessarily the academic painter who defends his own established manner against a novel way of making pictures or a threatened shift in taste. The leader of a revolutionary movement in art may get just as mad over a new departure because there are few things so maddening as insubordination or betrayal in a revolutionary cause. And I think it was this sense of betrayal that made Matisse so angry in 1907, when he saw what he called Picasso's hoax. It serves no useful purpose to forget that Matisse's contribution to early Cubism, made at the height of his own creativity, was an attitude of absolute and arrogant incomprehension. In 1908, as juror for the avant-garde Salon d'Automne, he rejected Braque's new landscapes, quote, "with little cubes," unquote. Just as by 1912, the triumphant cubists were to reject Duchamp's nude descending a staircase. Therefore, instead of repeating that only academic painters spurn the new, why not reverse the charge? Any man becomes academic by virtue of, or with, respect to, what he rejects. This academization of the avant-garde is in continuous process. It has been very noticeable in New York during the past few years. May we not then drop this useless, mythical distinction between, on one side, creative, forward-looking individuals whom we call artists, and on the other side, a sullen, anonymous, uncomprehending mass whom we call the public? In other words, my notion of the public is functional. The word public for me does not designate any particular people. It refers to a role played by people, or to a role into which people are thrust or forced by a given experience. And only those who are beyond experience should be exempt from the charge of belonging to the public. As to the plight here, I mean simply the shock of discomfort, or the bewilderment, or the anger, or the boredom, which some people always feel, and all people sometimes feel, when confronted with an unfamiliar new style. When I was younger, I was taught that this discomfort was of no importance, firstly because only Philistines were said to experience it, which is a lie, and secondly because it was believed to be of short duration. This last point certainly appears to be true. No art seems to remain uncomfortable for very long. At any rate, no style of these last 100 years has long retained its early look of unacceptability, which could lead one to suspect that the initial rejection of so many modern works was a mere historical accident. In the early 1950s, certain spokesmen for what was then the avant-garde tried to argue differently for abstract expressionism. They suggested that the raw violence and the immediate action which produced these pictures put them beyond the pale of art appreciation and rendered them inherently unacceptable. And as proof, they pointed out, with a satisfied gnashing of teeth, that very few people bought these pictures. Today we know that this early reluctance to buy was but the normal time lag of 10 years or less. By the late 1950s, the market for abstract expressionist art was amazingly active. There was nothing inherently unacceptable about these paintings after all. They just looked outrageous for a season, while we of the reluctant public were coming around. This rapid domestication of the outrageous is the most characteristic feature of our artistic life, and the time lapse between shock received and thanks returned gets progressively shorter. In the present rate of taste adaptation, it takes about 7 years for a young artist with a streak of wildness in him to turn from enfant terrible into elder statesman. Not so much because he changes, but because the challenge he throws to the public is so quickly met. So then the shock value of any violently new contemporary style is quickly exhausted. Before long, the new looks familiar, then normal and handsome, finally authoritative. All is well, you may say. Our initial misjudgment has been corrected. If we, or our fathers, were wrong about cubism a half century ago, that's all changed now. Yes, but one thing has not changed, the relation of any new art, while it is new, to its own moment. Or, to put it another way around, every moment during the past 100 years has had an outrageous art of its own, so that every generation, from Courbet down, has had a crack at the discomfort to be had from modern art. And in this sense, it is quite wrong to say that the bewilderment people feel over a new style is of no great account, since it doesn't last long. Indeed, it does last. It has been with us for a century, and the thrill of pain caused by modern art is like an addiction, so much of a necessity to us that societies like Soviet Russia, without any outrageous modern art of their own, seem to us to be only half alive. They do not suffer that perpetual anxiety, or periodic frustration, or unease, which is our normal condition and which I call the plight of the public. I therefore conclude that this plight does matter because it is both chronic and endemic. That is to say, sooner or later it is everybody's predicament, whether artist or Philistine, and therefore worth taking seriously. When a new and apparently incomprehensible work has appeared on the scene, we always hear of the perceptive critic who hailed it at once a new reality, or of the collector who recognized in it a great investment opportunity. Let me, on the other hand, put in a word for those who didn't get it. Confronting a new work of art, they may feel excluded from something they thought they were a part of, a sense of being thwarted or deprived of something. And it is again a painter who put it best. When George Brock, in 1908, had his first view of the Demoiselles d'Avignon, he said, "It is as though we were supposed to exchange our usual diet for one of tow and paraffin." The important words here are our usual diet. No one's saying to a man, "Look, if you don't like modern painting, why don't you leave it alone? Why do you worry about it?" There are people for whom an incomprehensible shift in art, something that really baffles or disturbs, is more like a drastic change. Or better, a drastic reduction in the daily ration on which one has come to depend, as during a forced march or while in prison. And so long as there are people who feel about art in this way, it is uninteresting to be told that there also exist certain snobs whose pretended feelings disguise a real indifference. I know that there are people enough who are quite genuinely troubled over certain shifts as they occur in art, and this ought to give to what I call the plight of the public a certain dignity. There is a sense of loss, of sudden exile, of something willfully denied, sometimes a feeling that one's accumulated culture or experience is hopelessly devalued, leaving one exposed to spiritual destitution, and this experience can hit an artist even harder than an amateur. This sense of loss or bewilderment is too often described simply as a failure of aesthetic appreciation or an inability to perceive the positive values in a novel experience. Sooner or later, we say, the man, if he has it in him, will catch on or catch up. But there is no dignity or positive content in his resistance to the new. But suppose you describe this resistance as a difficulty in keeping up with another man's sacrifices or another man's pace of sacrifice. Let me try to explain what I mean by the sacrifice, in quotes, in an original work of art. I think again of The Joy of Life by Matisse, the picture that so offended his fellow painters and critics. Matisse here disturbs certain habitual assumptions. For instance, one had always assumed that, faced with a figurative painting, one was entitled to look at the figures in it, that is, to focus on them one by one, as he wished. The painted figures, magnets to the eye, in Vasari's phrase, offered enough seeming density to sustain the long gaze. Thus, from all his experience with art, a man felt entitled to some pleasurable reward if he focused on painted figures, especially if these figures were joyous, female, and nude. But in this picture, if one looks at the figures distinctly, there is a curious lack of reward. There is something withheld, for the figures lack coherence or structural articulation. Their outlines are traced without regard to the presence or the function of the bone within, and some of the figures are insulated by a heavy, dark padding, those lines as thick as your thumb that Signac complained about. In the old days, one's first reaction would have been to exclaim, "This man can't draw!" But we have the painter's preliminary studies for the individual figures of this picture, a succession of splendid drawings, and these show Matisse to have been one of the most knowing draftsmen who ever lived. Yet after so many preparatory sketches, he arrives, in the completed painting, at a kind of draftsmanship in which his skill seems deliberately mortified or sacrificed. The heavy outlines that accost these figured nymphs prevent any materialization of bulk or density. They seem to drain energy away from the core of the figure, making it radiate into the space about them. Or perhaps it is our vision that is shunted away, so that a figure is no sooner recognized than we are forced to let it go to follow an expanding rhythmical system. It is somewhat like watching a stone drop into water. Your eye follows the expanding circles, and it takes a deliberate, almost a perverse effort of will to keep focusing on the point of first impact. Perhaps because it is so unrewarding. And perhaps Matisse was trying to make his individual figures disappear for us like that swallowed stone, so that we should be forced into recognizing a different system. The analog in nature to this kind of drawing is not a scene or stage on which solid forms are deployed. A truer analog would be a circulatory system, as of a city or of the blood, where stoppage at any point implies a pathological condition like a blood clot or traffic jam. And I think Matisse must have felt that good drawing, in quotes, in the traditional sense, that is, line and tone designating a solid form, a specific character, with concrete location and space, that such drawing should have tended to trap and arrest the eye, to stabilize it at a concentration of density, thereby drawing attention to the solids themselves. And this was not the kind of vision that Matisse wanted brought to his pictures. It is lucky for us not to have been polled in 1906, because we should certainly not have been ready to discard visual habits which had been acquired in the contemplation of real masterpieces, and to toss them overboard overnight for one painting. Today, this kind of analysis has become commonplace because an enormous amount of the century's painting derives from Matisse's example. The free-flowing color forms of Kandinsky and Moreau, and all those paintings since, which represent reality or experience as a condition of flux, owe their parentage or their freedom to the permissions claimed in this work. But in 1906, this could not have been foreseen. And one almost suspects that part of the value of a painting like this accrues to it in retrospect, as its potential is gradually actualized sometimes in the action of others. But when Matisse painted this picture, Degas was still around, with 10 more years of life in him. It was surely still possible to draw with bite and precision. No wonder that few were ready to join Matisse in the kind of sacrifice that seemed implied in his waving line. And the first to acclaim the picture was no fellow painter, but an amateur with time on his hands, Leo Stein, the brother of Gertrude, who began, like everyone else, by disliking it, but returned to it again and again, and then, after some weeks, announced that it was a great painting, and proceeded to buy it. He had evidently become persuaded that the sacrifice here was worthwhile in view of a novel and positive experience that could not otherwise be bad. So far as I know, the critic to speak of a new style in art in terms of sacrifice is Baudelaire. In his essay on Aang, he mentions a shrinkage of spiritual faculties, which Aang imposes on himself in order to reach some cool classic ideal, in the spirit, so he imagines, of Raphael. Baudelaire doesn't like Aang. He feels that all imagination and movement are banished from his work. But he says, "I have sufficient insight into Aang's character to hold that with him this is a heroic immolation, a sacrifice upon the altar of those faculties which he sincerely believes to be nobler and more important." And then, by a remarkable leap, Baudelaire goes on to couple Aang with Courbet, whom he also doesn't have much use for. He calls Courbet a mighty workman, a man of fearsome, indomitable will, who has achieved results which to some minds have already more charm than those of the great masters of the Raphaelesque tradition, owing doubtless to their positive solidity and their unabashed indelicacy. But Baudelaire finds in Courbet the same peculiarity of mind as in Aang, because he also massacred his faculties and silenced his imagination. Quote, "But the difference is that the heroic sacrifice offered by M. Aang in honor of the idea and the tradition of Raphaelesque beauty is performed by M. Courbet on behalf of external, positive, and immediate nature. In their war against the imagination, they are obedient to different motives, but their two opposing varieties of fanaticism lead them to the same immolation." End quote. Baudelaire has rejected Courbet. Does this mean that his sensibility was unequal to that of the painter? Hardly, for Baudelaire's mind was, if anything, subtler, more sensitive, more adult than that of Courbet. Nor do I think that Baudelaire, as a literary man, can be accused of being typically insensitive to visual or plastic values. His rejection of Courbet simply means that, having his own ideals, he was not prepared to sacrifice the things that Courbet had discarded. Courbet himself, like any good artist, pursued only his own positive goals. The discarded values, for example, fantasy, ideal beauty, had long lost their positive virtue for him, and thus were no loss. But they were still felt as a loss by Baudelaire, who perhaps imagined that fantasy and ideal beauty were yet unexhausted. And I think this is what it means, or may mean, when we say that a man, faced with a work of modern art, isn't with it, in quotes. It may simply mean that having a strong attachment to certain values, he cannot serve an unfamiliar cult in which these same values are mocked. And this, I think, is our plight most of the time. Contemporary art is constantly inviting us to applaud the destruction of values which we still cherish, while the positive cause, for the sake of which the sacrifices are made, is rarely made clear, so that the sacrifices appear as acts of demolition or of dismantling without any motive, just as Courbet's work appeared to Baudelaire to be simply a revolutionary gesture for its own sake. Let me take an example from nearer home and from my own experience. Early in 1958, a young painter named Jasper Johns had his first one-man show in New York. The pictures he showed, products of many years' work, were puzzling. Carefully painted in oil or encaustic, they were variations on four main themes. Numbers running in regular order, row after row, all the way down the picture, either in color or white on white. Letters arranged in the same way. The American flag, not a picture of it, windblown or heroic, but stiffened, rigid, the pattern itself. And finally, targets, some tri-colored, others all white or all green, sometimes with little boxes on top into which the artist had put plaster casts of anatomical parts, recognizably human. A few other subjects turned up in single shots, a wire coat hanger hung on a knob that projected from a dappled gray field, a canvas which had a smaller stretch canvas stuck to it face to face, all you ever saw was its back, and the title was Canvas. Another, called Drawer, where the front panel of a wooden drawer with its two projecting knobs had been inserted into the lower part of a canvas painted all gray. How did people react? Those who had to say something about it tried to fit these new works into some historical scheme. Some shrugged it off and said, "More of Dada, we've seen this before. After Expressionism comes nonsense and anti-art, just as in the 20s. One hostile New York critic saw the show as part of a sorrowful devolution, another step in the systematic emptying out of content from modern art. A French critic wrote, "We mustn't cry fraud too soon." But he was merely applying the cautions of the past. His feeling was that he was being duped. On the other hand, a great number of intelligent men and women in New York responded with intense enthusiasm, but without being able to explain the source of their fascination. A museum director suggested that perhaps it was just the relief from abstract expressionism, of which one had seen so much in recent years, that led him to enjoy Jasper Johns. But such negative explanations are never adequate. Some people thought that the painter chose commonplace subjects because, given our habits of overlooking life's simple things, he wanted, for the first time, to render them visible. Others thought that the charm of these paintings resided in the exquisite handling of the medium itself, and that the artist deliberately chose the most commonplace subjects so as to make them invisible, that is, to induce absolute concentration on the sensuous surface alone. But this didn't work for two reasons. First, because there was no agreement on whether these things were, in fact, well painted. One New York critic of compulsive originality said that the subjects were fine, but that the painting was poor. And secondly, because if Johns had wanted his subject matter to become invisible through sheer banality, then he had surely failed, like a debutante who expects to remain inconspicuous by wearing blue jeans to the ball. Had reticent subject matter been his intention, he would have done better to paint a standard abstraction, where everybody knows not to question the subject. But in these new works, the subjects were overwhelmingly conspicuous, if only because of their context. Hung at General Headquarters, a Jasper Johns flag might well have achieved invisibility. Set up on a range, a target could well be overlooked. But carefully remade to be seen point blank in an art gallery, these subjects struck home. It seems that during the first encounter with Johns' work, few people were sure of how to respond, while some of the dependable avant-garde critics applied tested avant-garde standards, which seemed suddenly to have grown old and ready for dumping. My own first reaction was normal. I disliked the show and would gladly have thought it a bore, yet it depressed me and I wasn't sure why. Then I began to recognize in myself all the classical symptoms of a Philistine's reaction to modern art. I was angry at the artist, as if he had invited me to a meal only to serve something uneatable like tow and paraffin. I was irritated at some of my friends for pretending to like it, but with an uneasy suspicion that perhaps they did like it, so that I was really mad at myself for being so dull, and at the whole situation for showing me up. And meanwhile, the pictures remained with me, working on me and depressing me. The thought of them gave me a distinct sense of threatening loss or privation. One in particular there was, called Target with Four Faces. It was a fairly large canvas consisting of nothing but one three-colored target, red, yellow, and blue, and above it, boxed behind a hinged wooden flap, four life casts of one face, or rather of the lower part of a face, since the upper portion, including the eyes, had been sheared away. The picture seemed strangely rigid for a work of art and recalled Baudelaire's objection to Aang, "No more imagination, therefore no more movement." Could any meaning be wrung from it? I thought how the human face in this picture seemed desecrated, being brutally thingified, and not in any acceptable spirit of social protest, but gratuitously at random. At one point I wanted the picture to give me a sickening suggestion of human sacrifice, of heads pickled or mounted as trophies. Then I hoped the whole thing would come to seem hypnotic and repellent like a primitive sign of power. But when I looked again, all this romance disappeared. These faces, four of the same, were gathered there for no triumph. They were chopped up, cut away just under the eyes, but with no suggestion of cruelty, merely to make them fit into their boxes, and they were stacked on that upper shelf as a standard commodity. But was this reason enough to get so depressed? If I disliked these things, why not ignore them? It was not that simple, for what really depressed me was what I felt these works were able to do to all other art. The pictures of de Kooning and Klein, it seemed to me, were suddenly tossed into one pot with Rembrandt and Giotto. All alike suddenly became painters of illusion. After all, when Franz Klein lays down a swath of black paint, that paint is transfigured. You may not know what it represents, but it is at least the path of an energy or part of an object moving in or against a white space. Paint and canvas stand for more than themselves. Pigment is still the medium by which something seen, thought, or felt, something other than pigment itself, is made visible. But here, in this picture by Jasper Johns, one felt the end of illusion. No more manipulation of paint as a medium of transformation. This man, if he wants something three-dimensional, resorts to a plaster cast and builds a box to contain it. When he paints on a canvas, he can only paint what is flat, numbers, letters, a target, a flag. Everything else, it seems, would be make-believe, a childish game, let's pretend. So the flat is flat and the solid is three-dimensional, and these are the facts of the case, art or no art. There is no more metamorphosis, no more magic of medium. It looked to me like the death of painting, a rude stop, the end of the track. I am not a painter myself, but I was interested in the reaction to Jasper Johns of two well-known New York abstract painters. One of them said, "If this is painting, I might as well give up." And the other said resignedly, "Well, I am still involved with the dream." He too felt that an age-old dream of what painting had been, or could be, had been wantonly sacrificed, perhaps by a young man too brash or irreverent to have dreamed yet. And all this seemed much like Baudelaire's feeling about Courbet, that he had done away with imagination. The pictures then kept me pondering, and I kept going back to them, and gradually something came through to me, a solitude more intense than anything I had seen in pictures of mere desolation. In Target with Faces, I became aware of an uncanny inversion of values. With mindless inhumanity or indifference, the organic and the inorganic had been leveled. A dismembered face, multiplied, blinded, repeats four times above the impersonal stare of a bullseye. Bullseye and blind faces, but juxtaposed, as if by habit or accident, without any expressive intent. As if the values that would make a face seem more precious or eloquent had ceased to exist, as if those who could hold and impose such values just weren't around. Then another inversion, I began to wonder what a target really was, and concluded that a target can only exist as a point in space over there, at a distance. But the target of Jasper Johns is always right there. It is all the field there is. It has lost its definitive there-ness. I went on to wonder about the human face and came to the opposite conclusion. A face makes no sense unless it is here. At a distance, you may see a man's body, a head, even a profile, but as soon as you recognize a thing as a face, it is an object no longer, but one pole in a situation of reciprocal consciousness. It has, like one's own face, absolute here-ness. So then surely Jasper John's target with faces performs a strange inversion, because a target which needs to exist at a distance has been allotted all the available here-ness while the faces are shelved. And once again I felt that the leveling of those categories, which are the subjective markers of space, implied a totally non-human point of view. It was as if the subjective consciousness, which alone can give meaning to here and there, had ceased to exist. And then it dawned on me that all of Jasper John's pictures conveyed a sense of desolate waiting. The face to the wall canvas waits to be turned. The drawer waits to be opened. That rigid flag, does it wait to be hoisted or recognized? Certainly the targets wait to be shot at. John's made one painting using a lowered window shade, which, like any window shade in the world, waits to be raised. The empty hangar waits to receive somebody's clothes. These letters, neatly set forth, wait to spell something out, and the numbers arranged as on a tot board wait to be scored. Even those plaster casts have the look of things temporarily shelved for some purpose. And yet, as you look at these objects, you know with absolute certainty that their time has passed, that nothing will happen, that shade will never be lifted, those numbers will never add up again, and the coat hanger will never be clothed. There is, in all this work, not simply an ignoring of human subject matter, as in much abstract art, but an implication of absence, and this is what makes it most poignant, of human absence from a man-made environment. In the end, these pictures by Jasper Johns come to impress me as a dead city might, but a dead city of terrible familiarity. Only objects are left, man-made signs which, in the absence of men, have become objects, and Johns has anticipated their dereliction. These, then, were some of my broodings as I looked at John's pictures, and now I'm faced with a number of questions and a certain anxiety. What I have said, was it found in the pictures or read into them? Does it accord with the painter's intention? Does it tally with other people's experience to reassure me that my feelings are sound? I don't know. I can see that these pictures don't necessarily look like art, which has been known to solve far more difficult problems. I don't know whether they are art at all, whether they are great or good or likely to go up in price. And whatever experience of painting I've had in the past seems as likely to hinder me as to help. I'm challenged to estimate the aesthetic value of, say, a drawer stuck into a canvas, but nothing I have ever seen can teach me how this is to be done. I am alone with this thing, and it is up to me to evaluate it in the absence of available standards. The value which I shall put on this painting tests my personal courage. Here I can discover whether I am prepared to sustain the collision with a novel experience. Am I escaping it by being overly analytical? Have I been eavesdropping on conversations, trying to formulate certain meanings seen in this art? Are they designed to demonstrate something about myself, or are they authentic experience? They are without end, these questions, and their answers are nowhere in storage. It is a kind of self-analysis that a new image can throw you into, and for which I am grateful. I am left in a state of anxious uncertainty by the painting, about myself, and I suspect that this is all right. In fact, I have little confidence in people who habitually, when exposed to new works of art, know what is great and what will last. Modern art always projects itself into a twilight zone where no values are fixed. It is always born in anxiety, at least in Cézanne, and Picasso once said that what matters most to us in Cézanne, more than his pictures, is his anxiety. It seems to me a function of modern art to transmit this anxiety to the spectator, so that his encounter with the work is, at least while the work is new, a genuine existential predicament. Like Kierkegaard's God, the work molests us with its aggressive absurdity, the way Jasper Johns presented himself to me several years ago. It demands a decision in which you discover something of your own quality. And this decision is always a leap of faith, to use Kierkegaard's famous term. And like Kierkegaard's God, who demands a sacrifice from Abraham in violation of every moral standard. Like Kierkegaard's God, the picture seems arbitrary, cruel, irrational, demanding your faith, while it makes no promise of future rewards. In other words, it is in the nature of original contemporary art to present itself as a bad risk. And we, the public, artists included, should be proud of being in this predicament, because nothing else would seem to us quite true to life, and art, after all, is supposed to be a mirror of life. I was reading Exodus chapter 16, which describes the fall of manna in the desert, and found it very much to the point. In the morning, the dew lay round about the host, and when it was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoar frost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they wist not what it was. And Moses said unto them, This is the bread which the Lord hath given to you to eat. Gather of it every man according to his eating. And the children of Israel did so, and gathered, some more, some less. And when they did meet it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating, but some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And the house of Israel called the name thereof manna, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, Fill an omer of it, to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread that fed you in the wilderness. So Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. When I had read this much, I stopped and thought how like contemporary art this manna was, not only in that it was a godsend, or in that it was a desert food, or in that no one could quite understand it, for they wist not what it was. Nor even because some of it was immediately put in a museum to be kept for your generations, nor yet because the taste of it has remained a mystery, since the phrase here translated as wafers made with honey is in fact a blind guess. The Hebrew word is one that occurs nowhere else in ancient literature, and no one knows what it really means. Whence the legend that manna tasted to every man as he wished, though it came from without, its taste in the mouth was his own making. But what clinched the modern art analogy for me was this command, to gather of it every day according to your eating, and not to lay it up as an insurance or investment for the future, making each day's gathering an act of faith.